write, I began to think that the term paper was a rather fraudulent thing that our students had to pretend to be experts with footnotes and bibliographies and arguing theses when in fact often they just wanted to speculate rather than defend a point of view. Especially I thought the women as connected knowers weren't interested in defending a point of view so much as in entertaining the idea of alternate points of view. Therefore, my assignment was write four alternative first paragraphs to a possible essay on blank. And that way they could write parody, satire, fiction, and one of them could be the standard, my thesis is that. You know, one could be a standard term paper. Then here's another assignment I did in an effort to do connected knowing reinforcement. Jamaica Kincaid's wonderful little short story called Girl is about the voices in her from her childhood telling her how to be as a girl. I'd pass it around and ask everybody in the group to write their own version of girl, using the voices in their head from their early past about how to be a girl. Or for the men, they write boy. And I'm about to edit an issue of Women's Studies International Quarterly filled with samples of the girl piece collected from all over the world. That's a connective knowing piece, and it allows you to read, no, not to write on other versions of being a girl, but to write your own. Then non-lecture formats. Once at the University of Denver, in an effort to do connected knowing, I had to give a talk on this very problematical subject for me, rugged individualism. I'm very indebted to rugged individualists in the past who've been brave. On the other hand, the myth of individuality in the U.S. can be used to persuade people that it's a free country, your life is what you make it. If you're poor, you must want it to be poor. If you're rich, you deserve to be rich, etc. So I have very conflicted views about individualism as a myth and a phenomenon. So I put 22 chairs in a semicircle, each one labeled with a facet of myself, like reader of Field and Stream in the dentist's office. and mother of 10 and 12-year-old children, and daughter of a Presbyterian grandmother, granddaughter, and so on. And then there was a moderating chair in the middle I would use sometimes called central self, which was sort of what kept the rest from being too crazy. And I gave the talk, jumping from chair to chair, enunciating these many voices in myself, trying to connect with all that diversity rather than jam it into a form which would standardize it in somebody else's prose mode. Then in Pasadena, trying to do connected knowing with the audience. In that case, I had no chance for the workshop the next day, as I have with you. So how would we connect? So I said, well, we have 2 hours tonight. The discussion period will come first. My topic is women in the curriculum. For the first hour, we will talk about your reactions to that phrase and your associations with that phrase. And then we will have a break, and then I will construct the talk on the themes that you have laid out. So they laid out 17 themes. During the break, I created the talk from their themes. That's an attempt to go into a lateral relation with that audience at a time when I didn't have this two-part. Phase one today, I talk, you listen. Phase four, tomorrow, we're all together. And finally, recently, talking about feeling like a fraud, I've given a talk several years ago called Feeling Like a Fraud, in which I applauded women's feelings and men's feelings of fraudulence in situations in which the situation setting you up to fraudulently claim to an authority or excellence you don't feel you have. And it's wise, I said, to feel like frauds if the whole myth of meritocracy is working to make you seem like more than you really are relative to the rest. So I was asked to give a follow-up to it, Feeling Like a Fraud Part 2, and my name is not as well attended as Jaws 2, but very well attended for what it was. And now, this time I wanted to talk not about what's fraudulent in those systems like the podium, the fraud of this, because you know as much about this as I and any of you. And in different ways, you know, we all know a lot about teaching, feminist pedagogy. Okay, so I was trying to talk this time about authenticity. What it is in us that's authentically rooted enough to say, hey, this thing is a scam and a fraud. That voice. So this time I was trying to consult the authentic voice and give some examples of that authenticity creeping out into public. Well, I couldn't get it organized. And the more I couldn't get it organized, the more I realized, for me, the outline form into which I was trained to organize things is a fraud. And for me, the genre is the list. So I read it as a list. And at that point, a metaphor of taking people through my own house worked best. They can visit a few rooms or lots of rooms, and it doesn't matter in what order I show them our house, my house. So I said, I'll show you the house I go to when I'm feeling that fraud. fraudulence, and here are some of the things I have, thoughts I had in these different rooms of the house. And the metaphor now became authentic. And the aim was there to connect with the own alternate lateral voices in myself that were unable to accommodate that outline form as an honest form anymore. If you think I'm rambling today, that's a little bit of the problem. I'm not so serious on outlines anymore. I'm going to hustle through my last points here. 8, 9, 10, and 11. Contract grading is a way of taking the teaching learning situation out of that hierarchical. I grade, no, I test, you take. I grade, you accept format. Therefore, the teachers I work with have been trying to develop forms of contract grading to allow the how am I doing question to be settled pretty much in advance and on some agreed upon axis of expectation. The next example, at the lateral teaching or connected teaching, Vincent Harding, a very famous black scholar of black history, black religion, teaching at Iliff School of Theology, will not make up the syllabus for his course in advance. The students must make it up. Or rather, he'll provide the books once they've told him why they're there. What is it they need from that course in black religion in America? Why are they in this graduate course anyway? What are their expectations about what the course can do? And they need to go into retreat over that for about a week or sometimes 10 days. And he will not order the books. I mean, he will not create the book list till they've told him what they're there for. And then he can teach to that. Likewise, influenced by Vincent Harding, I once ran a course in this way. The final examination, always a problem. I asked the students to develop together as a communal exercise that examination they would have been happy with taking, that the way they would have wanted to be examined on this course. That was a communal effort. And then they gave it to me, and I took it. And I took it in public right there, out loud with them. And it worked to surface some of their real questions about the materials of the course. Because I had told them I really don't like fake questions which are there just to test someone. I think faculty and students alike should ask real questions. And finally, my own sense of how to do our hands finally resulted in a pattern whereby I make up an exercise that has six sections to it. In my last 5 years of teaching at University of Denver, where I directed American Studies, all my in-class things were like this. The exercise had about six sections, and it was lifted off a text or a painting. And the first question is ask the students to stay very close to the text or the painting and write very explicitly about something and the linkages of relationships of things in the work. And then the questions widened out to the point where the final one was really quite wild and was always a question I myself was interested in. And these, I thought, balanced, separated knowing with, if not connected knowing, a sense of my own vulnerability, because I felt that I didn't know how to grade the final questions I was asking. I wanted them to entertain these ideas that I hadn't gotten very far on myself. And those exercises for me were so enjoyable to grade that always, and this contributed to high enrollments in these classes, always I returned them the next day. I was eager to grade them. And for me, I gave up tenure at University of Denver in order to get entirely on soft money and to wing it doing feminist work. So in making that decision, I asked myself, what do I value in this teaching job? And for me, the things I valued were the title and the prestige accompanying it and the in-class teaching. And the things I hated about it were the grading. I couldn't do it in my own way on these exercises. And the sense of having to impose exterior standards of excellence on a group which was increasingly heterogeneous. So, for me, finding a mode of writing in class which I could grade happily, in fact, look forward to grading, I always grade that very night, was a break into what I knew was some sort of authentic connected knot between me and them. I'm finished with my formal comments now. I think we should take just a few minutes. I need a particular sense of what those of you who intend to come to the workshop tomorrow would like to pursue having to do with feminist pedagogy. Excuse me?
I just wanted to clap.
Oh, yes. I should clap for you because I'm not sure I think. Well, maybe given the rain, I would. When I arrived on this campus, I said, a May afternoon with the sun out on the Cornell campus, I don't think I would go indoors for anyone. So, thank you for being here. Yes?
Do you have strategies or negotiating between programs which would like to impose standards and those kinds of ideas that you're talking about implementing.
Right.
Then we do work under sort of structural imposition.
Right. And often, yes, okay. And do you want to name some names? In my experience, women's studies is often trying to aid in revision. At the same time, it's borrowing from departments like English, which don't want really to do the thoroughgoing revision work. Or they're willing to consider feminist criticism as a subdivision of English, but not to call any of the main assumptions of English teaching into question.
Well,
that would be my example.
In particular, I'm teaching a course on English writing, which comes under the English department. But it sort of has a special character in that things that might not be acceptable in any courses are acceptable there. You can try English writing, you can try things that you might not have to assign an analytical essay every single week.
Right.
And I'm not going to be teaching that course again. I'd like to somehow manage to negotiate between what it is that I find valuable there and what it is that I'm going to be asked to do in a different kind of course.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, first of all, we'll let you talk more about that, to tease out some of those other types they've been doing. And then we'll take a hypothetical course you're about to teach and talk about how you can work some of those other types of writing into the course. Because I know Mary Jacobus was telling me at lunchtime that her students have done all kinds of... The language I will use tomorrow in talking about this is that I think places we are in 1988 in institutions, in particular institutions, that we need to teach them a double vision about writing. But there is a part that works by the argumentative win-lose, adversarial, rhetorical style. My attempt was great deal of what I believe. As Sally Gerhardt pointed out, it's basically a coercive use of writing. But there are some uses for it, in graduate school particularly. Also incorporated writing with memo. So, otherwise, it's amazingly little used in life, the argumentation, but they need to learn it as a construct. And I will talk about giving them the double vision of knowing that there are all these alternative ways of using writing, which do exist, need the power, and those are discredited for reasons, but in fact, those are the ones that are probably pulling through writing and didn't change the vote.
But being able to pick up on that, I'm not sure quite where I come out on it, but the identification of what you call the dying mode with either how many pin, or with corporate pack troubles in, because it seemed to me, you talked about various stages in which women
younger growing up
come to one of them is basically the nature's file and so on and so forth. One of them is the one who comes and say, I don't believe a word of it, all the things I've been told are a lie. Then they need to link up with what you might call the political. And it seems to me that if one says that, if one restricts it to the dining and eating game, as an academic game, which is, of course, we would say, that's a mode we're too familiar with, and if you become overly emphasizing the relational, the celebratory, the fact of the matter is, if you want to talk about, let's say, black people in America, you do have to talk about the condition of slavery, you do have to talk about oppression. If you can't, that's constitutive of experience. And in the same way, you could say, well, they. The experience of women is constituted by gender oppression. So it seems to me that the move from what you call phase 3 to phase 4 is overly resolved, and also overly, in a way, simplifies the problem. And in the same way, it seems to me that the notion of contestation is something like a political conversation, something that gets lost if you only label contestation as
a game of
academic men play.
No, it's a game of work plays as well. I mean, it's much wider. But two things are conflating. One is their account of five epistemological ways of knowing that I was referring to at lunch, and that wasn't the life stage development thing. That was, if they interviewed women as knowers, they found that there were many different positions they could be in, and they didn't call these stages, and they didn't say they were sequential through life or through development or anything like that. So I probably too hastily talked about that, but it is not a sequential model. It's just alternative positions. Now, with regard to my phase theory model, for me, it is crucial to go from thinking chiefly about women in phase 3 as problems, having had problems, having been oppressed, to thinking of us as valid in our own terms and having had really real world experience, and look, it hasn't blown up yet. And that's likely due to women's work in doing the assignment, thinking of holding it together, and that's not a bad word. I loved him. I was always grateful not to be born as my brother. We had to prepare to kill. So, in the repertoire of teaching styles that I'm talking about tomorrow, I'm trying especially to develop the lateral ones, but I do not think that the issues-oriented teaching, content work, adversarial habits that go with it can be tossed out. It's just that to see life, to say that the main teaching of women's studies is that life is oppression, struggle, resistance. That for me just doesn't do it, and we need modes of teaching that go beyond being fighters in the resistance. And right now, the problem with the teaching styles and writing styles most classes are teaching is that kids are being taught to fight for their ideas in print. We need that, but also we need to know, who is this fighter? What's her voice? What is her deeper imagery? Are we talking the same language here during this workshop tomorrow?
I think I'm wanting to say that the notion that the indication that the fighter, that the political struggle, is in some way contained by a relational struggle, doesn't jive for me with a much wider political set. In other words, that the good work of the world is done by women. I still want to say, but that's a kind of privileged view of women's work. I still want to say that. I can't not say that. Even though I can't talk on my own. In that way, it seems to me that it can only come from a sense that the problems have somehow melted away of deep inequality, for instance.
No, but I'm going to do a big leap now. My black friends
between women, so let's
say the black women have got a real sense of identity now, helping black women in the United States, those who were raised with a cultural isolation in the rural South, and that gave them the voice they're now using. Any struggle which against the rest of us. And I think in women's cultures, what Paul Marshall called being among her, the culture of black women's knees, where the little ones heard the oral patience of their mothers talking about everything, and not about racism chiefly. That's what gave them that power, okay? And in the model of talking about women are at the bottom, first of all, the gender oppression of men having to live up to or down to images of masculinity is undid, because they're seen as top. Moreover, an effort on behalf of women is an effort to how to move to what they have, which I fear very much. I think that is
done. Yeah, but that's to say, that's to assume that sales all the struggles are for liberal feminism.
No, I'm talking deeply about the feminism.
But is a relational model maybe I'm wanting to speak from a more Marxist model, in which, yes, I think conflict is there. And that what troubles me is relational model can blind one to that.
Well, it's true that several things. The relational model can seem, in other words, when made as a relational model, it's an account of women as bonding, as caretaking, as doing the work behind it. That can seem sentimental. It can be used against women to say, well, basically, you do the weak stuff of being nice, and you do it so well, just keep doing it, and you have to develop a different voice to just keep being different like that, and let the power structure stay where they are, and then we'll handle everything. So the word of Gilligan, I'm quoting Nancy Helling now from the Psychology of Women Quarterly, the word of Carol Gilligan, identifying women's voice as the effort is based on ethic of care, can be used against women. All right, so that creates, though, for me, not a blackout, where I'm putting today's floor, but a caution. Do not mistake this work of caretaking as unrigorous. And you and your infant son know that. Keeping from hitting him, I don't know if it's a problem for you, but keeping it all together has not been some affair of sentimental bonding. Moreover, the strength we develop in doing that is the produces the voices we need in policymaking at the international level. You will never get the resistance voices of the women's movement making international policy, because basically they're attacking a model, and the voices of attack will never speak for America, but the voices of dreaming of more inclusive personalities in our men and in our women, and to go back to pedagogy, in our knowing. That model can sell itself. That is the kind of contribution the American experiment has tried to make so far. And images are simply trying to overturning a system in which you see yourself as forever entrapped is for me not politically or epistemologically satisfactory. I know so much that the men in my departments didn't dream I knew. Because being their frame of reference, they couldn't see it. No, I'm sorry, hear it. They hadn't been given the tools to know what it was, and I wasn't given the tools to talk about it, but I knew a lot more than they. And there's research on women that indicates this falling women's culture. One does need to be careful not to have it used against women, but it's not a fundamental empty thing for caretaking. The bringing forth and caretaking for the human race, I see it as the base of civilization.
I was wondering if one of the things that differentiates phase 3, 4, and 5 is that the phase 3 is really backward looking, and phase 5 is way forward. It sounds to me really as though, as you said earlier, women can't think about their oppression all the time and get things done. And I wonder if some of what's going on in the shift from 3 to 5 is shifting from what you have to do away from thinking about the oppression that you have labored under, that is moving from conflict to actually doing something, even, you know, just outside the mode of conflict, shifting towards the future.
Yes, I think for me it's worked that way in the past, and inventing a lecture which I could deliver from 22 points of view came directly from having primary responsibility for a family in which all the voices were different. And in the family work, you try to get a forum where the aim is not to win, but when you have children, you're trying to give them all sort of equal time, all chairs, all throughout the development of their personality. That created this form. I believe that if I had simply seen myself as made in unconfident in the existing system, that is, they want me to stand up and speak my mind, and I can't because I was never given confidence, looking at the thing, there wouldn't have been such a creative solution to that, and the solution did come out of the phase 4 experience of being one on many, a body in the body of the family. And I look to, see, I think much of it is fiction as I see it. It's both that phase 3 issue. When Mrs. Ramsey was talking about this great conversation, why don't we take recording and lunch conversation? Mrs. Ramsey, her general wants to light out as far as that women's issues. God knows. It's also about her making a mending of a perfectly astonishing fabric. And I believe that is what created the new style of the book. It's not that Marx, the pre-Marxist, pre-feminist thinking, well, not feminism created the style of the book in the sense that phase three doesn't create a new style of being. Oh, well, I speak so provincially here as an American, but Carlson Rosenberg talked about being young and running a 1 week workshop on her camel in a big house outside Paris. And she brought together these women, women from 13 countries, and they all analyzed the family. And what she said is, it just dawned on me too late as it was ending, that each person brought her own national experience and the needs of women in her nation in particular to bear on this. And that's why we really couldn't talk together until it was too late. She said, the Italians wanted to know who was doing the work. The English wanted to know who has the money. The Germans asked who has the power to make the decisions. The French wanted to know about the deep analytic structure. And the Americans wanted to talk with how women had coped with their circumstances and pragmatically invented coping mechanisms. And she said, now imagine that follows from the national experience of women in each of those cultures. So that we should have seen that at the beginning and said, here's the elephant, and here are the main ways of seeing it.
I'm going to do it.
The family itself.
Portraits.
There's a incredible passage in the line, that's where Lily is thinking about what blazes up, this sort of orgy that blazes, blood and blood colour of the sea, and the intoxicating liquor around Minter and Pool, and they're natives and fixers, and then she says, there's something about this thieves and devours the treasure of the family in the house. And it's as though the problem about sexuality, the problem about domestic sexuality, is that it devours and consumes. And so that I again want to say, when we say that the family gives us, so the family is a model for how we speak to each other and give each other space, let's not forget the family is also absolutely implicated in all kinds of oppression.
True, but did you think I said we need to do away with phase 3 consciousness and just do phase 4? Because for me,
no,
it's not a either
or. I thought that there was a danger that one saw them as fables.
Yeah, Well, there is a danger with typologies in general, and particularly this one, if it implies that the further you go, the better off you are. On the other hand, in a world threatened by nuclear weapons, I think getting past the winners, losers is now a very, that is, phases one, two, and three, issues, phases, losers, I mean, issues, winners, losers, is a very important mandate for us. So teaching connected knowing with people of other cultures, in which we become national bodies and the bodies of the globe, does for me have a higher moral priority. It's one of my forms of political activism to do this teaching toward imagining peace rather than dwelling on dangers to subordinates caused by dominance. The whole idea of domination and subordination is there in phase three, and it sort of dissipates in phase four when you insist that Russia and the US be seen as in it together. We all both have to survive. So that Virginia Woolf does contain the genius that she is. Mr. Ramsey's phase one, oblivion of females. His appreciation of his star graduate students at the dinner party, you know, the favorite who were invited for the weekend. And it also includes the systemic understanding of sexism and other hierarchical systems. And it also contains that the celebration of what there is in her that made it go together for all of her children and made them want to keep coming back. And that is the part that I think we need now to emphasize more. And first of all, name. You can't even name it. Because you're right, if I call it family, then you can leap in there and say that the family's in the service of all the pyramids, and that's also true. So, but if you call it bonding, it sounds sentimental. And my co-author Elizabeth Minnick says, don't tell me about bonding, I don't want to hear another word about bonding. It's not that she doesn't believe in it. She thinks that women can, that the larger clarities can be lost if you talk about anything with affective content. So, we're really sort of talking the same language. I'm pressing toward phase four, and you're saying, watch out. That can do him all the work, I think. So, yes, I stand warned. With regard to pedagogy, though, I want every student to think of himself as a knower, not just as a receiver of knowledge of others. And therefore, pedagogically, I think, instead of having them write always back to the lighthouse, they need to be making their own whatever it is in these diverse forms of expression. So some of the teacher seminars I run usually, you might think it's sentimental, Elizabeth thinks it's sentimental, but we end up with very much patchwork imagery, very often the whole wall of the seminar. I'm about to run a seminar at Wellesley for 50 school teachers from a 9-state area on that book with two of its authors, and we'll discuss their typologies, their epistemologies, their sense of types of knowing. And I guarantee that at the end of that time there will be a patchwork of some sort on the wall, created of stuff, innovative assignments they have brought and tacked up for each other to see, plus some pictures, newspaper articles. It's the pastiche. I was taught things that as kids stuff, the third grade bulletin board, but now I really value it.
I
want
to say that
we're going to continue this reception.
There's a reception in the next year.
More questions then. Thank you.